website again for everybody's kildare.ie. You can check out kfmradio.com later on, and we'll have details up as well. And final question for you, Carmel, and very briefly, what are you and your fellow councillors going to do for Sharon Nolan and those businesses and residents who have issues with the current setup, the lack of parking facilities?
The lack of parking, well, as Sharon knows, I did have a motion down. I did get four suggestions and solutions, and I'm working with the residents of Canal View to look at which of those.
And what about
the
businesses? Are you going to bring that back to County Council attention?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm on with the parking department the whole time about solutions for parking in Salland.
All right.
But again, we can't magic parking spaces, you know. So it's to try and find how we can make it easier for those who live there and who work there to be able to park there when they need to.
Yes, and we're all for supporting those hospitality businesses that have had such a time, but that can't be at the expense and inconvenience to other businesses, which might impact negatively on them. And I agree, Carmel, the trick here is to get the balance that it's a win-win for all concerned. So I know Sharon Nolan wants you and other councillors, whether it be Bill Clear or whatever, to keep a focus on that at County Council level, and we'll keep a focus on it here as issues arise. Thank you for joining us this morning. Thank you indeed for that and joining us. Because we've also had an email regarding issues in Milltown, and in the second hour we'll be returning to the whole area of Poplar Square when we'll be joined by Councillor Shamie Moore.
Kildare Today with Clem, Owen and Kira.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Okay, coming up this hour, we'll be going live to Haiti to hear from a newswoman, head of programmes with ActionAid Ireland, on the devastation caused by the earthquakes in that country. How fortunate we are here, despite all the issues that are impacting our quality of life, in contrast to what's happening in Haiti. We'll also be returning to the controversy around the outdoor dining facilities and the gross littering of Nace, particularly at night time and at weekends. Free racing for punters at Punchestown today. We'll hear about the return of racing there, and but you must register beforehand. And we'll be marking National Poetry Week. We have a lovely William Butler Yeats poem for you, and also as Nace is selected as the poetry town for County Kildare, we heard from Dr. Mary O'Donnell, the Nace Poet Laureate, yesterday for the county, on a lovely poem that she has. Well, we'll have another one maybe today on those cards, postcards that they're handing out in various businesses around the time at town. I think it's a lovely initiative. And also, just to remind you again, in association with Ciro, they're producing 100% fibre broadband, now available to 27,000 homes across Athy, Clane, Kilcullen, Kill, Nace, Newbridge, Prosperous and Salons. You can check out their website, ciro.ie, for more details. They've given us €1,000 in cash to give away to some lucky listener on Friday week. So each day on our shows, we're picking two qualifiers per show. At the end of the day, around between 5 and 6, Paul Power and K-Drive will whittle those 10 qualifiers down to just two, and they go into the grand final on Friday week. If you want to take part, you can WhatsApp or text the word SPEED with your name and your location now to 0833 97 97 97. That's the word SPEED. Text 0833 97 97 97, or indeed WhatsApp as well. Moving on, the Minister for Defence, Simon Coveney, says discussions are at what he calls an advanced stage on the establishment of an independent review into how the Defence Forces deals with allegations of sexual harassment, discrimination and bullying. The topic came to the fore again over the weekend with an RTE Radio 1 documentary, The Women of Honour, presented by Katie Hannan on that occasion. I haven't heard the full documentary, but I believe it's striking, and I have it on my list to do so this week in regards to that. However, 21 years ago, my next guest, then an army officer in the Irish Defence Forces, did his PhD thesis on this very topic. But did nothing happen? I'm joined by Dr. Tom Clonan, security analyst and retired army captain. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Clem.
Thank you for joining us again. 21 years ago, Tom, tell me about your PhD thesis.
Yeah, so I came back from overseas in 1996, and I applied for permission from the then chief of staff to do, and essentially what was an equality audit of the Defence Forces. And so I embarked on that PhD process for 4 years, and unfortunately in doing so uncovered shockingly high levels of sexual assault, sexual violence of all kinds, up to and including rape. And I would just be careful about one thing, Clem. These aren't allegations. These are disclosures. Women don't come forward and lie about these things. These are disclosures. And the women who spoke on Women of Honour on Sunday, it's the first time in 20 years I've heard anybody from our Defence Forces speak, well, apart from myself, speak on the record about their experiences of harassment and sexual violence. And that is very tough on them and their families. And I know that there'll be people listening this morning from the wider military family, and I'm a member of that family, dysfunctional and all as it might be at times, we're still a family. And so it's going to impact on a lot of people, and it's a very distressing and a very difficult subject. But I suppose, Clem, my PhD thesis, which has been available, and it's available online. Any member of the public can just Google Tom Clonan DCU thesis and you'll see it. It goes into forensic detail about the discrimination, bullying, harassment, sexual assault and rape. And these are first-hand accounts from over 60 women in the Defence Forces that I interviewed, 43 at home, a maximum variation sample across the Republic, and then a control sample of 17 women that I interviewed in the Middle East in the summer of 1999. And all of the experiences that were recounted by the Women of Honour on Sunday, they're all in my doctoral thesis. They've been there for 21 years. And I also identified the causes of this phenomenon in the Defence Forces. And I also set out exactly what the organisation needs to do, the remedies to put an end to it. But in that 21 years, I have never once been contacted by the Department of Defence. I've never had any contact from the military authorities or the general staff until just recently Mark Mellett, the chief of staff, got in contact to acknowledge the work that I've done. But nobody has ever engaged with me and asked me or acted on the findings or the recommendations of that research. And I'm disturbed, frankly, to hear the minister say that they're at an advanced stage of appointing nominees to an independent review. I mean, the documentary went out on Sunday. So what process are they using to, allow people to, put in an expression of interest? Or how are they, advertising these nominations? How are they being interviewed? Or is this another Catherine Zappone type appointment that Simon Coveney picks up the phone and rings people he knows and said, will you sit on this inquiry? That's not how we should be doing our business. And so we just don't know what they're up to. But I can tell you this much, the women who spoke on Sunday, people like Karina and Yvonne, they absolutely must be front and centre at this inquiry. It needs to be a new inquiry. It can't be piggybacked onto an independent monitoring group or anything like that. And it has to be completely independent. It has to be professional. And the women have to be at the heart of it, and they have to be there in the room when the decisions are made about who goes on this inquiry and what the scope and parameters of it are.
Can I, Tom, I'm just glancing through your thesis, all 220 plus pages of it, and what I'm intrigued about is, given how comprehensive that is and the abuses that you say that you've discovered at the time, when you actually presented, did you present your thesis to the department and the Defence Forces at the time?
It was published by the university as are all doctoral theses, and I also presented it to the then Chief of Staff. I was a staff officer at Defence Forces headquarters at the time. I was actually working for the Chief of Staff, and I was a highly valued member of the organisation. I know there are people listening to this who, I don't know if they've heard this before. I was a highly valued member of the organisation. I had extensive overseas service. I had completed a master's degree, a PhD. I was promoted. I was in the staff officer with the chief of staff. The minute I presented those findings to the chief of staff, that was the end of my friendships, my community and my network of support. I was immediately sent to Coventry. I was told to go FU, the rest of that word, myself. I was told that I was full of SHI something.
Were those words actually used?
They were the words that were used, and this is on the record. I mean, I've written about this, I've broadcast about it, I've published academic papers on it in the international military community. So we didn't have the word whistleblower back then in 2000, and we didn't have the word whistleblower reprisal. But I was subjected to a sustained campaign of character assassination. The military authorities and the department alleged, amongst other things, that I had fabricated the research, falsified its findings, that I had concealed it from them, that I breached the Official Secrets Act, which is a criminal offence. I was told that a file was being prepared to the Director of Public for the Public Prosecutions, that I would face criminal prosecution and possibly imprisonment. I mean, that's what happened to me and to my family. We were subjected to the most sustained and rigorous campaign of character assassination. And some of the people, and all officers who were involved in that, have gone on to be promoted to very senior rank in the Defence Forces today. And some of them have gone on to take up very high-profile positions in Irish public life. And I believe, even now, even though my research is fully vindicated, they're actually quite proud of what they did to me and to my family. So that's why the women who spoke up on Sunday, that's why it's so important. The level of reprisal in the Defence Forces for people who speak out is very, very profound. And because of the nature of the community and the garrison towns that people often live in, like in Newbridge or Naas or Kildare, you know, people can be really isolated and targeted. You know, there's a lot of victim blaming, victim shaming. And certainly that was my experience. I mean, it was horrific. And at the time, I lost my mother, I lost my daughter, I lost a sister. One of my boys developed a very serious neuromuscular disease. And all my army friends knew this. And yet the abuse, physical threats, the physical assault continued because I blew the whistle on sexual violence in the armed forces.
All right. So, and that's extremely disturbing what you've just recounted there.
Yeah, but that's been on the record, Clem, for a long time.
And your thesis, by the way, is over 300 pages, not 200, as I might have said. I've just been scanning across it there. Now, the current Deputy Chief of Staff, Major General Sean Clancy, is quoted as saying the Defence Forces will fully support, facilitate and cooperate with any review of investigation to address the issues raised in the recent documentary. The direct quote is, members of the organisation have the right to be treated with dignity and respect in the workplace, he said, in regards, and we are committed to ensuring that their negative experience, that all personnel are provided with a safe working environment. The Defence Forces also said it wants to commend the bravery of the women who recently came forward and recounted their negative experience while serving in the Defence Forces. It goes on to say, Oglaigh na hÉireann welcomes and fully supports the announcement made by Minister Coveney yesterday that an independent review will be established to examine current policies and procedures dealing with workplace issues such as harassment, sexual harassment, bullying and discrimination. And of course, the issues that you've recounted, which extended, you say, as far as even rape. So are you at least encouraged now that there seems to be a different mindset or at official level, or would you still be sceptical that anything will come out of this?
I would have serious doubts because, you know, the department's statement and the Minister Coveney's statement that they're in an advanced stage of appointing people and designing the scope of an inquiry without any consultation to the people who spoke out on Sunday. They haven't even met them. And look, Clem, as always happens in these cases, over the last 72 hours, I've had a flood again of contacts from serving female and male members of the Defence Forces who are currently experiencing very, very distressing levels of harassment, bullying, and, you know, of a sexual nature. And over the years, because of the public way in which I was identified with this, because of the manner in which the military authorities handled it, I've been approached by dozens and dozens of women and men in Defence Forces who have experienced rape and sexual assault. I've been contacted by their legal teams. I've written dozens of expert reports to assist them in their search for justice or natural justice from the organisation. And the Defence Forces fights them right up to into court every time and puts them through an adversarial process. I was involved in one even just a couple of weeks ago. And that shows me an organisation that is not interested in resolving these issues, that is not interested or capable of moving forward in its toxic culture. And so that's the... And Clem as well, we need to be careful about language. I'm not claiming these things, or I'm not saying that these things... These are all facts that have been recorded. My research was fully supervised in the university, right up to the level of the registrar, and they were so concerned, they sent my work to DCU solicitors. And they, in turn, said that the findings were so grave, I needed to go back to the chief of staff and get further clarification and direction. So I met the chief of staff, Lieutenant General Jerry McMahon, in the summer of 1998, set out the issues, and he gave me explicit written instructions to complete the investigation. He said, dot your I's, cross your T's, leave no stone unturned.
Okay.
And I did that. And then when I reported it, subsequent general staff members and their staff officers did what Transparency International Ireland call a textbook case of whistleblower reprisal and character assassination, which I still suffer from, because and I'm just concerned that these women are not being listened to, because if the minister, having been made aware of a documentary, I don't know if he listened to it himself, is saying that he can say that they're at a very advanced stage of appointing people to the inquiry again, but what people, what expertise do they have? And I have never been approached by my research. So, you know, I have set out what all the causes of this are. They're very clear. I've also set out what remedies need to be put in place. Some of the people who are involved in the reprisal against me and some of the people I see in these court cases are promoted to very, very senior rank in the Defence Forces. So, you know, I did think that they had changed. I did think that they had put in place policies and practices that were changing the culture. But that culture is still there, and all the good people in the Defence Forces, all the people who don't engage in this type of behaviour but who sit back and watch and do nothing when they saw what happened to me, all the good people in, you know, that I knew in the army who did nothing, never lifted a finger, never lifted the phone to ask me was I okay, those people need to call out this bad behaviour. Okay. Because ignoring it is not going to make it go away, and I can tell you now, Clem, there are more disclosures that are going to come out in the next couple of weeks, and they are going to be profoundly shocking and profoundly problematic for everyone in the Defence Forces. And we face very serious security challenges in the next decade. We are staring down both barrels of some sort of an all-island situation here. We have to design the security, policing, defence infrastructure for an all-island entity, whatever that's going to look like. And for all of that to happen, we need a Defence Forces that is fit for purpose, that is professional, and we need to get away from the anachronistic 1920s based culture that persists in our organization. Our Oglignahearn, and those senior officers need to understand Oglignahearn doesn't belong to them, it belongs to the people, and we want it back.
On that note, and indeed, by the way, when we talk about sexual abuse, maybe the perception can be that this is regarding women. Well, it's not, because on this programme, some time back last year, we actually spoke with some male members of the Defence Forces who alleged that they were sexually abused by other men. In one case, an allegation made against an unnamed officer in regards to that. We've chronicled that in the past. So there's a lot more, it seems, to come on this yet. That's Dr. Tom Clonan, security analyst and retired army officer, who 21 years ago submitted his 300-page PhD doctoral thesis on this very topic. And here we are following that Women of Honour documentary, which is available on the RT radio player, if anybody wants to listen to it again and get the details behind that. Tom Clonan, and Tom, great to talk to you again. Thank you indeed for joining
Thanks
us this morning.
Thank you indeed.
And good morning to you.
Kildare Today.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Now you can keep your entries coming. Text the word speed or WhatsApp the word speed to 0833 97 97 97. You could be one of the lucky qualifiers that gets to the grand final to win €1,000 in cash on Friday week, thanks to Ciro, whose fibre broadband is now available across 27,000 homes in County Kildare. But first, Ciara Noble's in the news in Studio 2. And Ciara, I understand you might be going live to Haiti.
Yeah, that's exactly where I'm going, Clem. I have Trina Pender on the line, originally from Maynooth. She is now Head of Programmes with Action Aid Ireland. She's on the ground in Haiti, helping people who have been affected by the recent earthquake there. And just to remind people, on the 12th of January in 2010, a magnitude 7.0 earthquake struck just outside the Haitian capital, Port-au-Prince. An estimated 250,000 people died. Images showed the country was in ruins, the buildings had collapsed, there was lack of building codes there. And then on the 14th of August this year, a 7.2 magnitude quake struck Tiburon Peninsula. That's about 150 kilometres west of Port-au-Prince. And Trina does join me now. Good morning, Trina.
Good morning, Ciara. How are you doing?
Good, good. I don't know what time of the day it is there for you, Trina, but thank you for joining us. We greatly appreciate it. And I think just going over those stats there, the difference between the 11 years and those two earthquakes. The first thing is the earthquake in 2010, it was a 7.0 magnitude quake. But the one that just struck in August was 7.2. 250,000 people died in 2010. Can we expect that number to be to increase with the most recent quake in the country?
That's a really good question, Ciara, actually. No, the reason is that the 2010 quake hit Port-au-Prince, which is the capital, and it's very, very densely populated. So this earthquake hit the three departments that were most affected were Jeremy, the South Department, and Neep. So because it was in a rural area, the impact has been less. So far, about 2,207 people have been reported as having been killed in the earthquake. However, 1.6 million people have actually been affected. So, you know, what I'm seeing when I go to visit the communities is people are, you know, sitting beside their homes that are now in either a pile of rubble or else it's very, very severely damaged where they can't actually live or sleep inside their homes any longer. So there's about 130,000 houses that are currently in that situation. So we're desperately trying to get, you know, tarpaulins and shelter to people. The hurricane season is starting now in October. So we've had Storm Grace that followed the earthquake the following day as well. So shelter is a huge concern for people at the moment, as is food and access to water. So it is quite a lot of people who are being affected, even though the death toll is lower with this earthquake.
Yeah, and Trina, by mentioning this, I mean no disrespect, but you look at the 20-year commemorations of 9/11, horrific what happened there in New York City, Pennsylvania, and obviously Washington on that date, but just under 3,000 people died. You're looking at the earthquake in 2010, 250,000 Haitian people died. It's absolutely incredible reading those numbers. Now, you're mentioning, obviously, with this quake, it was a more rural area and about 2,200 people have been noted or have been confirmed as dead. When you put those numbers side by side, it really does hit you how much attention certain things in this world get versus other situations, depending on what country's affected.
True, that's true. I think we can't really be fooled by the numbers, though, in the case of Haiti, because, as I say, although, you know, it seems like the number of people who have actually died as a result of the earthquake, yes, it's much, much smaller than in 2010. But, as I said, there are 1.6 million people who have been affected. So I think the issue with Haiti is that, you know, these are people who are already in a awful situation of insecurity in terms of, you know, access to food, access to really basic rights before the earthquake even happened. 80% of the country here lives in poverty, and ActionAid, we've been working in development here for several years. So as soon as the earthquake hit, you know, we started to respond in the communities via our local partners, who are our local women's organisations. All of our staff here is Haitian. I'm just here for 1 month to help the team to get the response plan van, etc., together as a kind of an additional capacity. But all of our teams are working here on the ground. It's the local women's organisations who organise the distributions, etc. But several of these communities were already part of, you know, a food relief programme with the World Food Programme and ActionAid and others before this earthquake even struck. So people who were already in an awful situation, some of them living in homes that were damaged by Hurricane Matthew way back in 2016, are now just have everything wiped out. They have no access to food. They have, you know, their small businesses are now gone. You know, they used to sell agriculture products or sell, you know, clothing, shoes, secondhand things at the local market. All of that has now been lost. So people are desperate at the moment, and this is why we're trying to work with the local women's organisations to figure out in the community who is the most vulnerable, and then to get support to those groups, such as, you know, the elderly, pregnant women. I mean, I saw horrific things when I first arrived here, like pregnant women standing in the middle of the rubble, you know, covered in dust, small children, elderly people, and, you know, you just feel so sorry for them. You know, at the moment, we're still very much in the initial stage of giving out just things like hygiene kits to people so that they have access to things like soap, you know, aqua tabs for their water. There's an increased now risk of gender-based violence because the water sources that were in the community before have now been polluted after the quake, so people are having to travel much further to collect water, mainly the job of women. So we're giving out the hygiene kits with, you know, sanitary towels, toothbrushes, all the rest of them. Kind of things like, you know, bowls and spoons, etc., too, because people have lost absolutely everything. And we're giving, you know, cash so that people can have access to buying some shelter equipment, buying some food. But really, I guess we're trying to respond currently, but we're thinking and worrying about the long-term needs all the time, because we have some emergency funding currently, which we've had the amazing support of the Irish public and other some other donors as well. But it's just very, very difficult because hurricane season, as I said, is just coming up. Mm. And there's just so much need in Haiti. I think, you know, really and truly, it's one of the poorest countries. It's the poorest country in Latin America. Mm-hmm. As one of the poorest countries that I visited, and I've lived in Africa. So, you know, it's definitely a place that's in huge need at the moment.
Yeah, there's lots to unpack with the country in general. Trina, one thing I do want to ask you about quickly is the impact of the assassination of the former president, now Jovenel Moïse. He was assassinated on the 7th of July. How has that impacted the country, and in terms of the earthquake? Because listening to a majority now of Haitian citizens and residents, they believe that the government does not care about its people. They believe it's a corrupt government and it seems to be ongoing. I know that the Haitian Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, he was asked to appear for questioning in connection with the assassination of the president. So there's lots going on there, not just in terms of the earthquake itself.
Yeah, that's very true. There's a lot of political turmoil happening here at the moment, and that just obviously makes the entire situation worse in terms of earthquake response. I will say that Ariel Henry visited the area where I am currently, Jeremy, a couple of weeks ago. He visited the communities here, and he spoke with NGOs very briefly to speak about the government's response. I think, you know, there's a lot of insecurity in Haiti in general, especially in Port-au-Prince, but also in some of the areas where we're working. And there's difficulty in getting aid out to a lot of these areas because of not just criminal activity, but also just because the roads are now currently impassable and still remain impassable in some areas. But I think, you know, there have been lessons that have been learned from the previous earthquake. You know, government have tried to work with local communities a lot more in terms of, you know, what they want, and to try and include them more in the humanitarian response, which is exactly the work of ActionAid, where, you know, we're trying to put local women at the start of all the humanitarian work, so that they're leading it, because they're the ones who are the first responders, and they start, you know, with the response work immediately in the community before any NGO even arrives. But I think the Directorate of Civil Protection is the government group here that is responsible for things like disaster risk reduction, etc., you know, looking at risk plans in the community. And they are here, you know, they are coordinating. There is a lack of funding for them too. So I think it will remain to be seen that there's still a lot of need for international support in Haiti. And I think the government at the moment, as it is, it's probably, you know, trying its best, but there's a lot of things ongoing. You know, there's an expected election now in November as well.
Yes.
So it
does
kind of take a little bit of attention away from the rest of the response.
Okay, well, Trina Pender, originally from Maynooth and now Head of Programmes with ActionAid Ireland, thank you for joining me. And just to let our listeners know that you can go onto the ActionAid website. And Clem, just some interesting stats here before I hand back over to you. Currently, well, in 2019, the census showed that 11.26 million people lived in Haiti. At the moment, in terms of COVID-19, 50,624 doses of a COVID-19 vaccination have been given.
Wow.
14,382 people are fully vaccinated. That means that 0.1% of the population are fully vaccinated. So political unrest, an earthquake and such low numbers protected against this virus that is ravaging the whole world. It's quite unbelievable to think what the people in Haiti and obviously Trina and the likes who are out there helping are going through.
Indeed, fantastic interview. Well done, Kira, and well done indeed, Trina Pender, and marvellous work done out there. That's an astonishing statistic. We should consider how lucky we are with 85% plus of the people in this country vaccinated, nearly 7 million doses given out. After this, we return to the topic of the littering of Nace.
Kildare Today.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Okay, you can stop texting on WhatsApping now for our Syro promotion because we have our two qualifiers. We'll announce it before 11. Let's go and hear more about what's happening in Nace, because we were contacted by a number of councillors in regards to this. For example, Anne Breen, who brought up this topic recently, she's opposed to what's going on in terms of that, said in an email, "The sort of behaviour has been going on a long time. I've been continually complaining about it and have been just called a disgruntled councillor. It's time the people who can do something about it stand up and be counted. Also, can I ask, does anybody know who's responsible for organising the early morning clean-up in Poplar Square, apparently as early as 5 a.m. Volunteers are being paid. This is getting rid of the rubbish, but the side effect is that the general public is not seeing firsthand the consequences of this totally unacceptable situation. It seems if the Nace Ball were not highlighting the issue, a lot of people would be still unaware of what is really happening. I'm getting complaints daily," says Councillor Anne Breen, "about this disgraceful situation, and especially from age-friendly people who are reluctant to go near the place. I looked at that video again last night that the Nace Ball put up, and I think one of the issues, aside from the disgraceful behaviour, what seemed to be that all the bins, or whatever bins are in the area, are overflowing. Oh, and you have more, and another councillor."
Yeah, and that video is still available for people to check out on our Twitter page as well, at KFM Radio. But Councillor Shamie Moore is an independent councillor on the Nace MD. He's also Mayor of Nace as well. Shamie, good morning to you.
Good morning, Owen. Good morning, Ken. Good morning, listeners.
Shamie, what was your initial reaction when you saw that video? It's not something that has just happened in the last couple of days. It's happened for quite a while now in Poplar Square, the littering, the urination, defecation, etc.
Well, I think, first of all, you're generalising. But secondly, it isn't... I don't have to wait for the video to know what's going on in Poplar Square like a lot of other elected members. I would visit Poplar Square every Friday night, every Saturday night, on at least five occasions. I would circuit around, so I'm fully aware of what's happening and what has been happening in that area. I don't necessarily knock on doors to find out who's grieving or anything like that. I know there are problems, and I'm aware of the problems because I'm contactable as well. But the idea of urinating and any other type of abuse like that, there may have been one instance of a bad example. The urinating may be on one of the lanes that we're familiar with, and that shouldn't happen, but it's not to the extreme that there are hundreds of people doing that and I accept that it's not to be tolerated in any lane, in any street, or any part of the town. We're in a new era of cleanliness and health and everything like that.
Yeah, well, that's what residents, I'm sure, of Poplar Square and that area would say, that one person defecating in the area is far too many.
One person did it on one occasion, and that has been well and truly recorded.
But Jamie, I want to just come in here and say one thing. Right, fair enough. Defecation, urinating, I'm not so sure urinating would be as scarce an issue as the defecating, but whoever did that has the standards of a farmyard animal. But in terms, what is not in doubt at all, Jamie, is that the hundreds and hundreds of people congregating there are littering the place to a totally unacceptable level.
You are 100% correct. We're living in another new age in Ireland, and that's a new service industry has evolved around nighttime activities, and that's the delivery of pizzas and takeaway foods right to an assembly point, not to the doors of houses anymore, but wherever people are assembled, now these pizzas and takeaways are being delivered right to the site. And that hasn't helped because the pizza boxes are very large in comparison to the opening on the litter bin, and it only takes a couple of them to jam up. The litter bins themselves on re-examination are not exactly full. In fact, some of them are very poorly filled. So the stuff has been thrown wantonly on the ground without using the bins that are around.
What do you think is the solution here then, Jamie? Because in your email to us, you're calling for steps to be taken now to get rid of these problems that Poplar Square has seen. So what do you think the solutions are?
Well, all local authorities throughout Ireland are working with the government to ease back into what we might call a new normality. We have been cooped up in our homes and houses and away from contact with each other and interaction with each other, and there has been an explosion of nighttime activities on any sort of release along the way.
And what about the Gardaí implementing the laws that are already there, Jamie? There are laws against littering, there are laws against drinking in public spaces.
Yeah, but I can't speak for the Gardaí.
But isn't that the solution that Owen has asked about? The solution?
The solution will take a little longer than just a golden moment.
I'm not talking about a golden moment. I'm talking about if the Gardaí were patrolling that area regularly on the nights in question and showing up there, and people are aware of the fact, first of all, we shouldn't be drinking out at these tables. That's totally against the law. Not alone the littering. I know it can be difficult to prove who threw what where on the ground, but it's very easy to prove who's drinking at a particular table.
That's correct.
If the word goes out very clearly, the Gardaí are going to appear and summonses are going to be handed out. And I understand Gardaí are short-staffed, but we have laws for this. And the point that I made yesterday is the majority of people who would like to enjoy these public realm spaces responsibly and who are entitled to, the answer is not to close down these spaces because of the misbehaviour of a few.
You're 100% correct again. There is no intention of taking away the seating and other facilities that have been put in Poplar Square. It will be developed as a public realm for use in the future in Naas. And that is it. There's an element of people abusing it at the moment. And the Gardaí, following the meeting yesterday, will move in, and they will courteously explain to people that they will be gone from there by 11:30, and certainly public drinking will be done away with. Now, there is a critical date coming up on the 9th of October by which open admission to public houses and lounges will be allowed, and I think that will take away a lot of the people who are barred from pubs at the moment because they don't have certification or are not allowed in or they cannot bring out drink. So there will be changes en route to the 9th of October.
All right.
There will be more enforcement. There will be an earlier clean-up by the council against the hours that are there at the moment. They have put in extra services, but they were starting at the standard time, and that's somewhere between 8 o'clock and onwards. And we would be looking to have the area of Poplar Square cleaned up before that.
All right, okay, Shami. We'll
are
leave.
All happening at the moment.
All
there
right.
will be a statement later on today from Kildare County Council in relation to what has been agreed.
All right, great stuff, Shami. Thanks for that update, and come back to us with that statement in case we don't get it. We have asked Kildare County Council for a statement as well, and thank you, Owen, in regards to that. And one other email we got, by the way, was from Des Drum, well-known Halverstown cricketer. He said, well said this morning, that was yesterday morning, Clem, your strong words and litter are absolutely right. To say that education is the problem is just facile. We've educated and advertised for many, many years to almost zero effect. Litter and dumping have to be recognised as antisocial behaviour as well as an expense to society and treated as such by the authorities. It's illegal, punishable by fines, but when was the last time you saw a litter warden or saw the Gardaí treated in this way? Enforcement of laws on the subject are non-existent and have led us to the current position. Education on the subject has largely been a waste of time and money and will continue to be unless it is supported by firmer action, says Des Drum. And it's not just in Naas and Salins, which we featured earlier this morning, because I also had an email from Bridie from Milltown, and she called in and she said, she was speaking about the canal area in Milltown, about the amount of littering, dog fouling. She said Milltown Tidy Towns might be willing to provide a spokesperson, so we'll see, can we follow up on that. And she also noted that many drivers are travelling through Milltown daily and throwing their disposable coffee mugs from their windows in the village. That's the kind of thing that we're having to deal with in regards to all of this. Anyway, on to a happier note. Punchestown is racing today and Conor O'Neill is the CEO. Good morning, Conor. Thank you for joining us on the programme this morning. And as Kenny Everett, the comedian, you say, or something to the effect, it's all completely free.
Yeah, absolutely. The sun is shining and we're back racing, which is fantastic. And obviously, this is the first day we've been able to welcome people back properly to Punchestown since February 2020, so just nearly about 18 or 19 months ago. So obviously we're delighted to be in this position, we're delighted to be back racing, and it's free in today for anyone that wants to come. So anybody that wants to come racing in Punchestown today, we will welcome you with open arms. So,
but there is a TNC attached to that. They don't just turn up at the gate, do they?
No, so for contact racing, obviously we're very conscious with COVID there, and paramount to ensure we have it in a safe and controlled area. So to ensure contact tracing, we just do need you to go on in advance on to punchestown.com, whereby you simply provide your name and your email address and phone number, and you'll be sent an e-ticket, and you turn up with that e-ticket and we'll welcome you into the races. So we're delighted to be back. The first race is off at 1:30 and we've an 8 race flat card today at Punchestown, so all very excited. And like I said, the sun is shining, so very much looking forward to the day ahead.